host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockey Pediocast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me is my good buddy Sean Shapiro. Sean, what's going on, man?
Not much. It's apparently it's a. I forgot it was a holiday weekend until I woke up and realized that my kids didn't go to daycare today. So it was and realized it was a holiday weekend. But it's I guess I should have known that, right? Like there's pretty good branding in the hockey world, right? Right, Memorial Cup, right? We should know that. That's I feel like there's a. I've edited work around that in the past couple of days for our over at EP Rinkside and. So probably should have known it was a holiday weekend, but all the days, day off for the rest of the world. But there's still playoff hockey tonight, right?
Well, so that's fun. That's what I was going to say. There's no days off during the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Yes.
And,
yes.
And more, none more so true than tonight, because there's a big game six between the Stars and Golden Knights. And that's what we're going to talk about here today. We're going to record this thing, get it out so people can hopefully listen before the game starts. We're going to talk about the series as a whole. The first five games, well, we've seen the adjustments, the kind of roller coaster ride of good and bad from the Stars' perspective, and then kind of tee up game six and get people ready for that. So where do you want to start here? Do you want to kind of key in on the turnaround from the Stars' perspective, right? It seems like, I don't know how long ago it was now, 4 days ago, it was probably the most disheartening way you could lose, right? You go down 2-0, but it's too close. Yeah. Coin flip overtime games, you come home game three, you've had a fantastic home crowd all postseason, and you completely lay an egg. Like within a minute and a half, the game is essentially over. The rest is just, you may as well play with a running clock, right? There was no actual competition involved and you're going 3-0. And it's like, all right, we've seen comebacks like this happen before a couple times over the past decade or so, but the odds are still heavily against you. And just the fashion in which the Stars lost, I think in game three, made me think that this was all but a wrap, just because I felt like it was tough to come back from that. Now we spin it forward a few days. They've played their two best games of the series by far. Certainly game five was the best 5-on-5 performance they've played of either team in this matchup. Really, it's been a close series, but that was about as decisive a victory as you're going to get. And now we go to game six. They're back home. How do we feel about this? What spurred this turnaround? Let's get into all that good stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's you go back to game three and it's the like we know the Stars went to they technically had home games, quote unquote, home games in the bubble in Edmonton when they went to the final in 2020. But this was the biggest actual home game in 15 years. In game
I mean,
three.
you were in the house.
Yeah, I'm in the building there. And it's Ed, you go from the breakdown of it was the Vegas scores the first goal and that wasn't really like, and it feels like that really starts to take the air out of the building, but then the Ben penalty and the 5-minute major. And then basically it was the 2-0 goal that really just like started to like really break it where you're like, man, this series is over. You've seen the replay of the Ben cross-check on Stone enough times where, you know, this is not just a, this is no longer, this is going to be definitely going to game four, whenever it is.
Hey, Sean, to be clear, alleged cross-check, right? depending on who you ask, some parties might say he might have just slipped and then accidentally placed his stick on his neck. It's still really unclear. Yes, it's all up to interpretation.
Yes, clearly, right? Like we would have fallen. Who amongst us hasn't fallen and landed with a stick on someone's neck at some point?
Jamie's been around for a long time. He's not as young as he used to be, right? Getting a bit older, slips and falls sometimes happen with older age. I mean, listen, I'm not sure that's the case. That's the argument I would have necessarily gone with. And the fact that he had, 24 hours essentially?
Yes, to
concoct this with his team is hilarious. But the show goes on.
We'll never hear the true reaction that Pete DeBoer and Jim Nill had to that press conference. But I know, because Pete DeBoer is, as we've seen, he's very good at saying the right thing at the right time. Pete went to law school. He has lawyer training. He knows how to play things the right way. Jim Nill is very calculated in the way he speaks to the media. And when Jamie actually had his hearing with George Parros, Jim Nill was present. And from my understanding of it, Jim did much of the talking, which probably is the reason it was only two games and not more.
Right.
But I can only imagine like the punching the, like I can imagine Jim, and I picture like this Nil and DeBoer and Ben all sitting in a room, and they're like, okay, Jamie, they're going to ask about this. Prep for this. Okay, I got it. Pete goes and starts getting ready for his day and everything like that. And then picks up his phone and says, what? He said, what? Like what did we just go over? Like, I picture that happening on the back end. And now we'll never get Pete or Jim to admit it because they say the right thing. But I just imagine it's like he was the guy who went rogue against his legal team's advice when finally stepping up to a microphone.
Yeah. What are the, do we have any line on like what the timeline was of this plan coming together in terms of that was the direction they were going to go with in terms of the public comments, right? Like, cause I imagine all of this stuff is generally run through so many different voices and parties, right? I'm sure like the agent was involved. I'm sure the management, the coach, everything. Like this isn't a player going rogue, especially the day after, right? Like this has been planned. I'm assuming they just chose to go with that because I guess even though everyone can see how like thinly veiled and transparent it is, like I guess you're just not ever going to publicly admit that you kind of were frustrated, snapped, lost your mind, and just viciously cross-checked someone who was prone and lying in the neck, right? Like it's not going to go that way. So you just went with this sort of excuse, if you want to call it.
Jamie also, like it's, I do know, like one thing that broke down on the timing of it was there's Ben probably wasn't going to speak to the media until there was all the backlash after he didn't speak after and in the immediate aftermath of game three. It was something where I think if the Stars brass had been the ones picking when he would have spoke, he would have spoken right after the game. But I think it's one of those things where just a natural thing, like Stars PR focuses on who talks, not the, and Jamie decided he wasn't going to talk. And if he walks to his car, like he did, you can't really do anything about it. The space with Ben that just like kind of that's interesting here is some guys have, and as I say this, because I know firsthand from this, Jamie does not have nearly as an involved agent as some other people do. Like, so I remember when the other rather famous Jamie, Ben, Tyler Seguin incident I was a part of when Jim Leitz and I had a lovely conversation.
You,
had,
you
office.
And I, that might've been the first time we ever did a show together. We got together and did like an hour long breakdown years ago of how that came to be.
And, but I talked to Tyler's agent and I had quite the lengthy conversation that was even longer than you and I had on the podcast where Jamie's agent and I did not have nearly as long of a conversation. There was not nearly as much of, Jamie does not have a, like, can you imagine if Jamie had one of the more vocal agents, one of the guys who was going out on Twitter.
Right. Let's
more
say,
often.
Let's say it reminds of Schmal and Schmalz.
Yes. Yes. I think there's a different approach to how this is handled. Jamie is a little bit more of as his own, makes his own decisions on things like this. And I think,
It showed.
It showed. It definitely showed. And, it wasn't going to change any chance Jamie had of this being a one game suspension went out the window when the public comments were, I would have liked to not land with my stick on his neck.
Yeah. So. That's the one thing I would have liked to do differently. Yes. Okay. Well, let's, you know, he is coming back for game six, but I think that's such a, you know, you could craft a story around that. Certainly. Right. The captain coming back, he, it seemed like he wasn't going to get a chance to play in the series. Now he is. That's less interesting to me. I want to talk more about what we've seen, particularly in game five, right? Because you and I were messaging as that game was going on. You are tracking the shot locations and like the zone entries and stuff. I've been looking at the shot types, how they're being created, who's creating them, all that good stuff. And it really felt like it wasn't being reflected on the scoreboard for a long period of time, right? The Stars were down 1-0. They were down 2-1. Even the shots on goal were pretty close that you see on the broadcast. But for me, the way they were getting back to their roots in terms of everything that had made them successful all season prior to the first three games of the series really came back into focus here, right? Yeah. The rush shots were 14-5 at 5-on-5 in game five for the Stars. The rebounds at 5-on-5 were 10-1 for Dallas. And that is that's their two-pronged attack, right? They either get you off the rush or then they work the puck up to the point, take a shot with layers of screens in front, and either tip it or pounce on those rebounds. And that's something they really hadn't been able to, you know, form or materialize at all in the first three games. And that's credit to Vegas's defensive approach as well and their structure. But they've found somehow a way to break through that. And so for all the talk about, you know, Bruce Cassidy after the game framed it through the lens of what his team was doing poorly, right?
He, the
quote about 24 giveaways, you're going to lose to even the Arizona Coyotes when you play that way, which is just hilarious. Imagine just the Coyotes being like, oh, come on, man. Like, let us enjoy our offseason. We have enough of our own issues. But for all of that talk, I thought actually a much bigger issue for them was that Dallas really got back to kind of halfway through game four and then really all of game five playing exactly the way they need to play.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's something where there's a couple narratives that I mean, it's the playoffs. Narratives are great. Like, I mean, how many times are we going to on the broadcast tonight? Especially and if the Stars win tonight and force game seven, we're going to get the Jamie Benn story over and over and over again. And it's a fair story, but as you said,
it makes me a bit uncomfortable how it's being framed as like this guy, like,
yeah,
is coming back through this adversity. It's like, it's self-inflicted, right?
It's not for him. Yeah. I don't, same way. Like I actually like the Stars rallying so Joe Pavelski could play again. That was someone recovering from a concussion. Like, yeah, I don't,
you're
like,
are we ever going to see this guy again? Yeah. And then he miraculously comes back and scores a hat trick. That is cool. Right?
Yeah. It's like it's Jamie Benn coming back is the, like, it's the full heel turn of everything, where it's like it's this, like, right now the Stars are kind of a in vogue because of Joe Pavelski, like, good, like, bandwagoner fan to jump onto, right? If Jamie Benn comes back and scores four goals tonight and they go full villain, people start rooting for Vegas just from the outside perspective, because what he did was awful and he shows no remorse. So, like, it'll be part of the story and everything like that, but it's not really, to me, the bigger thing is the Stars, how they, as you said, how they changed the game, how they got back to their game. And I think one of the bigger, more impressive things is having a look at how this team's transition has built. This transition was built, like, the Benn storyline is the one that dominates the conversation and he's the captain, but one of the Stars' best transition players throughout the playoffs has been Evgeny Dadonov, and he's been out the past couple games. And to me, that's more impressive that they got back to their game. They got back to when they lost a player in the lineup who had actually been doing it pretty well the first couple games, one of the few guys who actually had been. And to me, that's the space where I look at with the Stars team, like, Benn coming back. It's a great storyline. I'm sure they'll play it up in the arena tonight, but the bigger thing from a Stars perspective, and as you touched on, is they're playing their game again. And it's funny. Like, I hate this. Like, I don't want Jamie Benn returning and his ouster to be taken away credit from what the actual story of the hockey game will be, because it's going to.
Yeah. Well, there's the story and then there's the broadcast story, right? And I think everyone is familiar with the difference between those two, are kind of what sells. Yeah. I mean, it's much more difficult for a broadcast to craft a story around, wow, Freddie Olofsson has come in and really provided some juice to this bottom six. You know, Kiviranta, playoff Kiviranta's doing it again. Landria finally scores two big goals and kind of rewards all those who have been talking about how he has much more offensive capability than maybe he's been able to show because of the players he's played with all year. Like, all of that stuff has happened. I think that's what's been amazing too, right? If you look at the game five, certainly Jason Robertson, and we can talk more about him continuing his goal scoring and his, like, how he's, like, you look at that goal and it's that second effort off of the initial one that maybe shows the difference between what's going right for him now and where his struggles were earlier this postseason. But after that, it was really a lot of that bottom six that was creating for them. And so I don't know, like, how do we rationalize that, right? Is it just kind of like a natural ebb and flow of a playoff series? These two teams were much closer than the 3-0 lead for Vegas indicated. Is it a matter of, you know, Dallas having some added desperation, right? You go down 3-0, you show that resolve or however you want to frame it, and then you give that push, and then now it's on Vegas to retaliate. Is it Vegas, as Bruce Cassidy is trying to portray it, kind of taking their foot off the gas a little bit because you go up 3-0, the Stanley Cup is within reach, at least the Stanley Cup final and your appearance there, you know, Florida's waiting for you. Like, how do we juggle all of, is it probably a combination of all those things? Like, I that's how I feel. But I mean, I think depending on your angle, you could really kind of plow ahead with whatever take you want.
Well, I think another like angle on it that's important, that is just kind of, it's because it's only in the grand scheme of things, it's not sexy to make talk about something that's happening 3 minutes a game, but like Thomas Harley past three games, the Stars have bumped Thomas Harley to about 18 minutes a night. I mean, that's something where they haven't done that all in the offensive zone. There's spaces where Heiskanen and Harley are on the ice together for offensive draws together. Like, the coaching staff is doing something that frankly they should have done 12 games ago. And right. You talk about kind of the transition part of the game. That's a space too, where another angle of this is like the Stars they're getting out of their own zone better. They're trusting Harley more, and Harley has been playing with more of that. There is more of a confidence to it. He's played, when he plays more minutes, he plays better. He's one of those guys who he builds off his own ego in a healthy way. So that's happening. And then the other thing too is just, you look at I'm going to use this to detract from Ben for a second, because everything's okay. Going to be given Ben's. We've talked glowingly about Joe Pavelski. You and I probably, I think, fit entire episodes about Joe Pavelski, but mm-hmm. Joe Pavelski basically took over as the captain, basically. And basically it was, and he is, well, he obviously handles himself better in the media than Ben does. He is, I think, more of the back against your wall leader who can actually help a team beyond just the emotional sense. We always hear, I covered the Stars forever, right? Like, Jamie Benn is the emotional leader. The team follows him everywhere, but he's always been the emotional leader. It's never been Jamie Benn is the guy who's going to, you're going to go to if like, hey, should we draw, how we draw this playoff? Joe Pavelski is that guy. And I think part of that too is you look at, as this team comes back, and if the Stars win tonight and force game seven and win a game seven, a ton of credit's going to go to Joe Pavelski, and rightfully show, because he was the guy they needed in that room from a player perspective. Even though he's obviously not the most fleet of footed, he's not the one pushing the transition, but he's still, I mean, it's funny, like looking at it, where I was talking after game five, it's because Ben's obviously going to come back into the lineup and things like that. And it's, you kind of feel for like Freddie Olofsson. Like, Freddie Olofsson's probably going to be the one that comes out, but like Freddie Olofsson nearly ends game four with a minute left. Freddie Olofsson's helped create a fourth line that actually attacks the transition. And so if Ben comes back in and you move Mason Marchment to that fourth line, like, I mean, honestly, I honestly think the best play, I don't think they'll do it because he's a big signing and they would do it, but like, to me, I think the better move is to put Ben in for Marchment and keep Freddie Olofsson in my personal opinion. But I don't think, I don't think coaches and contracts will allow that to happen.
Yes. Well, okay. Let's, you mentioned Harley there. I wanted to, you know, speaking on this theme of how it felt like things changed a bit in game five in particular, was that born out of necessity in terms of, you know, especially you're down one, you have multiple one goal deficits, mm-hmm. your season's on the line. And so you're kind of going, and then it helps that, you know, Ryan Suter once again makes a very questionable defensive mistake on one of the goals. Was it that, or was it an actual sea change here in terms of usage? Because you look up after game five, Thomas Harley played just 36 5-on-5 seconds fewer than Ryan Suter for third most mm-hmm. on the Dallas Stars team, which is it's been going that way, but it's a massive massive change and a representation of it from the way Pete DeBoer has used his defensemen all postseason, right? Where it was like Heiskanen up top by a wide margin and Ryan Suter, and then another massive golf, and then like everyone else. And so in this case, you see Harley finally, I think he played 4 or 5 minutes of those with Miro Heiskanen, mostly in offensive zone shifts, right off of draws and stuff. They help create one of those goals playing together. It's a very enticing proposition, right? Because everything that they've struggled with in terms of foot speed, breaking the puck out, sustaining offensive zone pressure, Harley helps with that significantly, as opposed to having Suter out there with Heiskanen. Yeah. And so that's been one of my issues, where I understand you want to have Miro out as often as possible, right? Because he's one of the only guys who can at least put up some sort of resistance against Eichel's line, in particular with the foot speed Eichel has as a puck carrier. But then if you just have Suter attached to his hip, then that means that's a lot of Ryan Suter. And in this case, yep. if you're actually splitting up those shifts and getting Harley out both with Hanley's pair, but also situationally with Heiskanen, all of a sudden, I think that's an entirely different landscape and kind of game environment for the Stars, and one that really intrigues me. So I'm kind of curious to see if that finally unlocked something, or if it was just kind of like a one game blip.
It's a really good question. I think the causation for it doesn't matter if they keep doing it. Like, I think it happened because, well, our season's on the line. You try everything. I think that's why it happened in the first place. But I think we'll definitely learn a lot based on whether you stick with it or not. Because that to me is, the Stars are a better team. They have a better chance of winning tonight. They have a better chance of winning the series when you go with that approach. And to me, it's pretty clear that that is the way to go. Now, the causation and whether it was overreacting one way or the other, that's fine. But I think you have to build off of what you did with Harley in game five. And I think that is going to be the big key. And it's, I the coach will take, if it works, coaches will take credit, but like, I truly think it actually happened because like, we're down, season's over. Let's try something. So,
I mean, 82, 5-on-5 minutes in the series for Harley, shots are 48-29 for the Stars, high danger chances, 18-9. The goals are even, but you watch the goal that he helped create in game yeah. five. That is why you want Thomas Harley on the yeah. ice, especially yes. in the offensive zone, right? You're like, certainly his breakout ability, he's had a few turnovers himself there dealing with Vegas's pressure of the series. It's a bit of an adjustment, mm-hmm. I think, in terms of like how aggressive and heavy their forecheck is and how more physically oriented it is than maybe Seattle's was in round two, that was more speed-based. But when he's on the ice in the offensive zone, a shot by him from the point where he's trying to place it at a forward stick to tip it, which is something the Stars do better than anyone in the league, is just, it's different than when a Lindell or a Suter takes it, right? Where it's like, yeah. you can tell there's some sort of actual design and thought and like actual talent in terms of placement behind it that gives them a better chance to score on those and turn them into scoring chances, as opposed to some of these other ones, even though in theory, it looks like the same shot based on where it's happening on the ice, the likelihood I feel of it actually being a scoring chance or goal is significantly higher when it's coming from Harley. So I just, yeah, I don't know yeah, how you go away like, from that.
Luke Lindenning and Esa Lindell are not combining for a goal. Ryan Suter and Luke Lindenning are not combining for a goal. Like give Glendenning credit. He's in the right spot. Him and Fox are creating havoc in front of the net. But like that goal is, if it's, he's got the stick out, the tip is there. It's already, Hill is already fighting further through it. If that shot is Suter, it's probably staying right on the ice. It's not tipped. I mean, it might be tipped, but it's staying right on the ice, and it's not at the spot where it can take the route it does. Like, I 100%. It's the launch point, the actual thought process into it. It's approaching something with an art as opposed to being, I'm gonna mash buttons and throw things.
Well, on Friday's show, I laid out a full passionate case about how, regardless of the result of this series, even if the Stars come back and win the Stanley Cup, they have to really strongly consider buying out Ryan Suter this summer. And purely just because of a sentence you said a couple minutes ago there, where like, how much of this is planned, how much of this is coaching, who deserves credit for it? I just don't. And I really like Pete DeBoer as a coach. I think compared to his peers, he's at the top end in terms of like thoughtfulness, and even if he's not using analytics the way we think about it, like, he's giving a lot of credence and thought to a lot of this stuff beyond just the usual kind of hockey cliches, right? But even he has shown that he's not immune to whatever spell a veteran defenseman casts on NHL coaches. And that's happening again here, where I'm sure he doesn't want to be playing Ryan Suter 23 to 25 minutes a night at this age, but whether it's because he feels like he's his safest option or he just feels most comfortable with him out there, he's sending him out there for these shifts when you and I and anyone watching these games at home can notice what an issue that presents, right? And how in so many different facets of the game, it's a massive problem, and yet it keeps happening. And so regardless of what happens here, you almost have to just get him out of there just to clear the runway for a guy like Harley or whoever else you want to bring in to actually have a legitimate opportunity to take these minutes. Because as long as a player like him is there, coaches are going to keep giving them minutes.
Well, it's as a GM, you have to be the adult in the room sometimes. And that's what it is. It's like, and I'm going to use an example as someone who has children, because I've seen this before, right? Like, you have multiple toys all in the living room and everything like that. And the if they're in the room, they're going to be played with. If you take them away, and if you take them away, like, for a while, my daughter really liked Kinetic Sand, and it was really annoying because it gets in everything and stuff like that. Well, if you just take it away from them, they're not gonna use it. So, like, Ryan Suter is the Kinetic Sand. Like, you don't like it's not like the coach is the child with toys. The coach is like, oh, it's there, I'm gonna play with it. But if you just take it out of the room and it's gone, well, then he has to use something else. So that's like it's exactly that. It's you as the GM, as Jim Nill in this situation, you have to be the adult in the room and realize that you can say, like, oh, you know what? We'll move Ryan Suter to a 12, 13 minute guy, third pairing guy. It's one thing to say that in the offseason meeting. And Pete DeBoer probably would say it in the offseason meeting, but then game two of the season, when it's a 3-2 game and it's close, Ryan Suter's playing 20 minutes again. So I like, yes, it's taking the tool away from the coach. It reminds me of one of the things that the Stars have had made decisions about this before. One of the things, when I remember Jim Nill told me when near the end of the one part two, the Ken Hitchcock Redux in Dallas. I remember having a conversation with Nil about Spezza and Hitchcock, and Jim was willing to at least acknowledge that there was no way that both Jason Spezza and Ken Hitchcock could be back the next year. And so they were going to have to make a decision on whatever they made the decision on, one would impact the other. And so whether it was Ken Hitchcock, and this is a timeline I've never actually been able to nail down, because whether it was the decision that they were going to stick with Spezza led to Hitchcock basically going, or Hitchcock going, then we're keeping Spezza, I'm not sure which, but basically Jim Nill has had to make these decisions before. Jim Nill had a similar decision to make with Thomas Harley, where the Stars, I've actually heard that within the Stars organization, Jim Montgomery was a big Tom, really liked Thomas Harley in training camp. But Jim Nill also was a spot where Jim Nill wanted to send Thomas Harley back to junior, because he felt that he didn't want Harley to get to 12 games and then the coach be like, I don't really have a spot for you. And be in that spot where he would have had to play there. And so that was where Jim Nill was the adult in the room when Jim Montgomery wanted Thomas Harley a little bit more. And Jim Nill felt like, you can want him, but you have to understand that if you have to play him, and you can't mess up my contract cap situation. So Jim Nill will have to make that decision. He's made those decisions before. It will be very interesting to see how it happens, because it's also on him where, now, if the Stars go and win the cup, he gets a little bit more carte blanche. He can buy out everyone. He's got a cup. He can do whatever he wants. But it will be, if they lose tonight, if they lose Wednesday, Jim Nill is also having to wear a little bit, because he's the one who signed Ryan Suter. Like, at the end of the day, he's the one who signed him, and he's the one responsible for him.
Well, he is, and he's talked a big game in media throughout the year of, like, deflecting criticism away from him, right? And, like, acting like it's a non-issue. Yeah. I mentioned this on the Friday show as well, though. If you look at the contract details that he did sign Ryan Suter to, and it was an egregious decision to give him a four-year deal, certainly. Yeah. The way it was signed, though, with a $1 million signing bonus in year one being the only signing bonus they gave him, and it being a front-loaded deal, a back-loaded deal as well, that gave them an out clause here, especially this summer, where you can buy him out, even though it's a 35-plus-year-old deal. You don't have to carry the full freight of it. They only cost them like $800K or something on the cap the next 2 years. And so, you know, you certainly, whenever you structure these contracts, a lot goes into it. You have to like map out every single possible best and worst case scenario accordingly, certainly. So I don't think when they signed it, they were like, oh, after 2 years, we're going to buy him out or whatever, or how long it's been. But I do think part of it is keeping that door open. And so for all his talk about how it's like, this is a non-story, it clearly is a story. You're seeing that this postseason. And I do think that is going to happen this summer, and it needs to. Just it's time. I can't, I love watching Thomas Harley so much, and like so much about the Stars team. And then you watch some of these plays that are being screen captured and gift of Ryan Suter. It's like, man, this is, it's just such an antithesis to what this team actually is and the way it was built. And I just, it's so frustrating to me, Ryan. It's so frustrating to Sean. I just can't handle it.
Well, I mean, it's, if you're Jim Nill too, and once again, this is a conversation that you have to have over the summer. You're not have before game six, but like you talk about, you have to wear the Ryan Suter contract, but you also traded a first round pick for Nils Lundqvist. And you're telling, like, you talk about addition by subtraction and freeing stuff up. Like, if you're Jim and you are someone who has valued and put so much importance on a first round pick, like he has, like he never trades first round picks. And then you did it for Lundqvist. You can't not have him in the lineup next year. Those conflicting spaces all start to come together, where what's one of your simplest ways to fix multiple problems? How do you make sure Thomas Harley plays big minutes? How do you make sure that Nils Lundqvist is actually in the lineup? There's a buyout.
So. Yeah. How do you make sure your team is actually better? Okay, Sean, let's take our break here. And then when we come back, we'll talk about a few other things regarding this Stars Golden Knights series and wrap it up there. You're listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Breaking down the top stories in the NHL every day. The Jeff Merrick Show. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back here in the Hockey PDOcast with Sean Shapiro. Sean, we've talked a bit about kind of like the team side of it. Let's talk more about some individual performances here from the series so far. I'll give you the floor here. Do you want to go Jason Robertson or do you want to go Jack Eichel? Because I feel like they're the two most interesting sort of individual performances we can key in on.
Let's start with Eichel. There's some similar things to both these guys, but so let's start with Eichel here.
Okay, let's talk with Eichel. So he still hasn't scored a goal yet in this series, and it has not been for a lack of chances. He's gotten at least a couple pretty much every single game, and he's created a bunch for his teammates as well. So I think he's been phenomenal. Something I noticed in rewatching all the shifts he's taken, not only in this series, but throughout this postseason, is it's really interesting how he's attacking opposing defensemen. So he's a right-hand shot, right? And he keeps coming down the left wing and entering the zone kind of along the boards on the left side. And I think part of it is a testament to how just smooth of a skater he is and how scared opposing defensemen are of being put on a highlight reel where Adam Filipovic tweets out an embarrassing clip of them getting roasted. but there's a lot of self-preservation involved, even from a great skater like, say, Miro Heiskanen, where you're taking a step or two back more than you would otherwise to account for Eichel's game-breaking speed. And in doing so, you're playing right into his hands, because I'm sure if you give him a lane, he will take it to the net. But he's shown no interest so far in actually taking it on his backhand as he goes down the left side to avoid a stick check, right? All he wants to do is he sets you up by backing you off, taking a step or two into the zone on the, past the blue line, and then moving towards the middle of the ice, where he can then either like leave a little drop pass for a defenseman as a trailer or get it to someone else from a better attacking position in the middle of the ice. And maybe this is part of my my upbringing and training playing basketball as a youth over the years, where you were always taught like to, if you're going to get beaten, at least get beaten by taking away the other player's strength, right? You don't want to go let them go on their strong hand. If they beat you going, if they're a right-handed player and they beat you going left, so be it. They made a great play, but you can never just give them a free lane to go on their strong side. And in this case, that's exactly what they're letting Eichel do. Now, it's obviously easier said than done, I'm sure, in a lot of these video sessions in preparation for these games. The Stars have noticed this, and I'm sure they're telling their defensemen to pressure him and kind of angle him in a certain direction. And yet, once you see Jack Eichel bearing down on you with space and the puck on a stick, the calculus changes a little bit, right? And you go into that self-preservation mode. But I'm very curious to talk to you about that in terms of like seeing that on tape, how you prepare for it, how you defend it, because it's time and time again. It's like clockwork. And I would just love to see that little adjustment, but maybe the Stars just simply don't have the personnel beyond a Haskinen to actually be able to execute that plan, because a lot of these other guys are just clinging on for dear life and making sure they don't get embarrassed by him.
The interesting thing about Eichel to me too is how often he, like, he's a center, right? But he attacks like an offhand winger a lot. Like, that's like, it's something where, and now I'm a big proponent of positionless hockey in general. I think that's the way of the future of the game, but it is, I think so often from a defender mindset, so often we hear, oh, you don't want to give the center the middle of the ice. Yep. And so I think so often, because of Eichel's quote unquote natural position and everything like that, I think there becomes a default of like, well, we're keeping him to the outside where he's attacking to the outside. He's not coming in down the center. We're already kind of winning this. We don't really, like, I feel like there's already a bit of a natural, and I'm not sure how much that calculus actually happens in the game, but I think it's part of the defensive mindset to it. Cause he comes down, he attacks down the wing more. He attacks on his offhand. And and that line plays well off of it, right? Like they play really well off of it as a group and everything like that. And it brings a different element. And it's kind of one of those weird things where I wonder if Eichel was listed as a winger, right? Like if he was listed as a winger, if all of a sudden the defenseman is like, oh, I'll play this a little bit differently. I'm just controlling this. I just wonder if we still have a lot of programming that we have to get out of guys' heads. And I wonder if this is one of those programming things where you look at it, it's like, well, he's a center attacking down the wing. We're already winning a little bit. I wonder if that's a false narrative that kind of jumps into guys' brains.
Well, and I should say it's burning my mind in game four, later in that game, there was that one shift, right? Where at the start of the shift, he burns Ryan Suter, and then Ryan Suter goes off the ice, Eichel's still out there, and he basically regroups, and then he burns Thomas Harley off of a second individual rush. And in both those instances, the defender did step up on him a little bit, and he basically like put it in their skates, then made a crossover, got around them, and then got to the net. And so I acknowledge that it's a lot easier to be like, well, you need to do this a certain way, and then his skill still break through that. But I've in watching all of these shifts, I have never seen him coming down the left wall, be pressured by a defenseman into taking the puck as a right shot on his backhand and then making a play off of that way. He's made some passes off his backhand off the half wall on the power play, but on a 5-on-5 rush, he's never been forced to do so. And instead he's just, because of the space you're giving him, he's getting into the middle, and that's unlocking everything they're trying to do as a team. So it's just, you have to take away an opponent's strength, right? And if they beat you with their weakness, so be it. But losing to their strength is just a really tough way to go out. So that's something that I've kind of noticed and I've been watching, and maybe listeners and viewers can watch that at home tonight when they're watching this game. Do you want to talk a little bit about Jason Robertson now? Yeah. Because he's also been a story here for me where it's certainly all the goals have helped. At one point, I think before Ty Dellandrea's explosion, he had accounted for like half of the team's goals so far in this series.
Yeah, it was like of the 10 goals, he had 5 of them, I think it was at one point. Yeah.
Yeah. And the game 4 performance in particular was about as dominant an individual performance as you're going to see. Like, I thought he might get up to 20 shot attempts at some point because he had like 13 or 14 through two periods. It's been really rewarding and fun to watch, especially even that goal that I mentioned earlier in game 5, where he comes down the wing, takes the shot, it gets blocked, but then follows up on it and basically forces it through like sheer will into the net. Right. I think that has been, we've discussed throughout this postseason what his issues have been, whether he has had a nagging injury, whether it's been an adjustment to just how different the playoff game is to the regular season game. I think it's certainly looking like it was more the latter, because it just seems like he has adjusted to getting to his spots better by just fighting through it harder. I know that's kind of like a cliche thing. You want it more or whatever. All these guys want to win a Stanley Cup, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But like seeing him give those multiple efforts on these shifts, it's looked different than it did in the first two series beyond just obviously being rewarded for it with the goals he has.
Yeah, I think there's that. I think there's a bit of a... Yeah, I hate the narrative where like, oh, guys gotta want it more. Like, I hate that. Like,
I don't think his desire to win has changed at all. Yeah. But I don't think in pushing through contact, I do think that is a thing in the postseason.
No, I do think so. Yeah, like I agree with you. I think there is a of dealing with more of the mild annoyances, right? Like of dealing with of better,
especially
with
the
with
same
those.
With the same face over and over again, right? Over the six, seven game series, it's one thing if a guy bugs you on a Tuesday night in the regular season, and then you just don't see him for another 6 weeks, but then you have to do it all over again two nights later, and there's an accumulation effect, I think, to that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think he is. I think he kind of there's that fighting through it a little bit more. I think there's. I don't like the want it more, but I do think there is a bit of the internal pressure points that come from, I think there is a bit of the internal pressure points that come from, hey, he saw Roope Hintz kind of take over in round one. He saw Pavelski come back. And like, I think there's a bit of that internal pressure point of, A, seeing what they did too, but there's an emotional standpoint of pushing to that. It was like, okay, every part of the Stars' big, like, this is now every single series. If the Stars win this series, it will be largely because of what Jason Robertson has done this series. Series one, it was because of Roope, largely because of what Roope Hintz did. Series two was largely because of what Joe Pavelski did. I think there is a bit of an emotional driving point there that Robertson finds himself. And I also think that there's a, I think he's one of those guys too, where, and this is a human element to this, and it's hard to like put like a tangible on what is intangible, but I think there is the, oh, my game still works. I think there's part of that where you're not scoring, you're not finding the back of the net, and you start to wonder, okay, do you start to believe some of the outside noise that my game doesn't fit in the playoffs? And then you get that one. And then you get that, and then you have that success, and you're like, oh, well, F all those people. Like, they were wrong. My game still works. And I think there's two parts of that. And those things are very intangible, and I'm trying to make them tangible in the moment. And it's impossible to do it. But I think those things apply because his game hasn't changed that much. He's gotten more shot attempts, but it's not like he completely changed his game. It's not like he's trying to do something completely different. He just basically went back to doing what worked in the regular season. And I think part of that is all the type of things where he's very cool and collected about everything and everything like, but it's those spaces where when he's driving home and he's by himself, those are the things where I wonder how much those factors helped drive this, because I do think there's something to it.
No, I do as well. And you see a couple of the goals he scored are like those kind of greasy ones around the net, right? Where it's a rebound or it's a second effort. And then in game four, then you also see how that kind of unlocks what the other stuff, the more skill level stuff, which is that move he makes where he kind of climbs off the wall, cuts back in, snaps a wrist shot off the post. And that is Jason Robertson as well, right? And that's just stuff that wasn't really coming into play for him earlier on. And I think those two things kind of are connected in a way, even though it is difficult to sort of quantify for us.
One thing I really liked was I think there's times where players in general can get caught into a comfort bubble. And a lot of times the Stars power play runs with Robertson in that 1-3-1 with Robertson on the wing. And with Ben out, instead of bringing someone else into Ben's spot, they basically moved Robertson down to that spot with Pavelski still in the slot and Robertson down low. And now the Stars didn't have a single power play in game four, so who knows if that would have been the plan in game four. But I felt in game three, and it's the highlight reel eye-hand coordination that creates the goal that we all fall in love with. But I love that in game three, they're like, okay.
No, it's the opposite. Game three was the one where they didn't have any power plays. Game four was the one with the chances.
Sorry, game four. Game four is where he has the
goals.
Has the goals, and he has the highlight reel eye hand coordination, and it's great. And we all get attached to that. But part of it comes from he's in Ben's typical spot on the power play. They put Hintz in his spot. They brought Sagan in, and they bring Sagan onto the first unit. And I think part of that is also sometimes I think a player when getting put in a different situation, some guys respond well. Jason does. Some people don't. And I think that's another element too, where I don't know, like Stars get a power play tonight, who knows what it'll look like, but Jamie Benn can be annoying in front of the net. Jamie Benn has been that guy, but Jamie Benn is not making that Jason Robertson play that he made in game four. And I like Robertson in that role. I like the variety it brings to the power play when one shift you can roll out with Jason Robertson picking posts, picking corners from the top of the circle, and the other one where he's down low. I like that element of his game where when Ben and Pavelski are out there, you know they're not going anywhere else. It's not bad. It's not bad. Like it can be effective power play, but Ben is not going to Robertson and Hintz can rotate, right? Robertson and Hintz can alternate. Ben and Robertson are not alternating. You know what that power play is going to do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's much more predictable. Is there any other? Well, okay, so let's give the listeners something to watch for in game six here, right? Whether it's a matchup or whether it is a specific stylistic thing, what are we looking for here to determine it? Because, for all this talk about how I feel like the way these games are being changed or being played has changed in the past two, the Vegas Golden Knights still are up 3-2, even though they're on the road here in game six. Yep. I think Money Puck has them at like 75% or so to still win this series, which makes sense, right? They only have to win one of these next two. Game seven is going to be at home. These teams are about even. That makes sense. But I'm kind of curious. Like, I still think this Vegas team is terrifying from how deep they are and how many things they can do to you. What are we watching for in game six that's going to really give you a sense of kind of how this game is going to shake out?
I think Pete DeBoer can be ballsy and win. And I think Pete DeBoer can be ballsy and scratch Marchment. Like I think the Stars, one of the reasons they're going is that Olofsson was that spark they needed to create a line with Fox and Glendening that actually does something offensively. Marchment's been terrible in the playoffs. Like putting him on the fourth line, he doesn't bring speed. He's not going to bring anything to that line that Olofsson has. We know Ben's coming back in. I think Pete DeBoer can be ballsy and say, like, okay, I have a Domi, Kiviranta, DeLandria line that's working. I have a Olofsson, Fox, a Glendening line that actually is working. We have that top line that we know works. Like putting Ben with Sagan and with Johnston, I think scratching the big offseason signing and being ballsy and with your season on the line, I think Pete DeBoer can do that as a coach. That's something. Now, if he doesn't do that, which we can assume he probably won't, because this is podcast fodder and stuff that I would throw out there. But if he doesn't do that, I really want to see from a Dallas perspective. I'm really interested to see the Harley deployment tonight. We talked about it earlier. I just watched, like, is Thomas Harley being treated like your number? Is he actually being treated like your number two, or was that a one-off and it's going to go back to this? That's the thing for me. I mean, for Vegas, the other thing that I'm just interested of, just from a Vegas perspective, and it's easy to, it's a very cliched one, but I think it's true. I'm really interested to see how Aiden Hill responds from that third period, because he was Hasek incarnate for 43 minutes, right? And then Ty DeLandria beats him with a crap shot, and like I want to see how Aiden Hill really responds from that third period. I said this the other day, like I'm curious if, and for better or worse, I wonder if the Vegas goaltending brain trust has Jonathan Quick pull him aside and talk to him about, like, hey, this is, I don't know. I'm curious if that happens. Like, it's,
I mean,
I yeah, it's.
Well, no, here's the thing. Like, he made, but Aiden Hill did make some phenomenal saves.
Oh, yeah.
As game four went along, game five. Yeah. But I think the issue is that he had to make those saves, right?
Correct.
Because he made a lot of saves in the first three games. Very few of them were challenging ones because Dallas was not getting the looks that they typically get because Vegas was playing such a strong defensive game and keeping them to areas they were comfortable with. As game four went along, pretty much all of game five, they started getting significantly more of those high danger opportunities. And for as well as Halo's played, he hasn't been tested to that degree. And I wouldn't trust any goalie if they have to keep facing that barrage of tough looks from close areas to hold up, right? So I think that's really the story of the series. It's like he's playing really well in the first few games because they're playing so well defensively. Now Dallas starts playing the way they typically play. They've created more chances and the results have followed. And that's kind of where this game six hits its crossroads, right? And whether that continues or whether it goes back. And so I really enjoyed the series. I know the game three absolutely sucked, but for the most part, it's been a really close series. In the other four games, very closely contested. All of them could have gone either way. I think we deserve a game seven because we want more hockey. Game sevens are awesome. I'd love to see it. But game six really could go either way because both these teams are so close to each other. So
yeah, one thing the Stars, someone said after, it's not on Twitter. Like it was after game three, someone said there's anywhere from 5 to 10 NHL games remaining in the season. And
that's just a sad thought.
Yeah, no, but that was after game three. And the Stars, by winning tonight, will have done their part to get us as close to 10 as possible. So
I would like to see it. Okay, Sean, this was a blast. Looking forward to your coverage of the rest of the series and the rest of this postseason. People can check out your Substack, Shapshots, right?
Podcast. We actually have a real URL now, just shapshotshockey.com. Real there URL. We're moving up in the world.
All right. Well, follow you at John Shapiro. Check out your blog there. We're going to have you back on later on this postseason. Enjoy game six tonight to all the listeners. We'll be back tomorrow with another episode of the Hockey PDOcast, as always, streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network.